Hello and welcome to the ESG Fitness Podcast. The aim of this podcast is to help you think, learn and grow, and hopefully smile and laugh on the way too. My aim here is to break down your barriers to taking action and provide you with evidence-based diet and exercise information in a fun and interesting way. I hope I nail that and I hope you enjoy. If at any point you are enjoying this and you think, wouldn't it be great to work with Emma? You can head to esgfitness.co.uk to find out more information. Without further ado, because I hate long introductions, here is this episode. Hello and welcome to this episode of the ESG Fitness Podcast. I have Dr. Hannah Ritchie with me today. Hello, how are you?
Hi, good. Just Hannah Ritchie's been more than sufficient.
Well, I like the full title. And also my mum pointed out that when you were on, what was the Radio 4 programme you were on?
I think it was BBC, one of the BBC ones. Oh.
Yeah, anyway, they were like, this is Dr. So-and-so man, Dr. So-and-so man, and then just Hannah Ritchie, and she was like, she was not happy with it. So now I have to give you your full title.
What I thought was funny, so recently I did a talk at Dundee Uni because Emma's mum invited me, and she was like giving me a tour of the department, and when we went in, the lady in the reception thought I was one of her students. She was like, was this one of your students? And your mum was like so outraged. She was like, no, she's my speaker. They just look very young these days.
I love that. They just look very young these days.
I do look about 16, so that's quite valid.
You do look quite young. But, I mean, it's a good thing, right?
Right, yeah.
And then it's always impressive when you come out with such incredibly intelligent things.
Yeah. Like, I just loved it. She was like so outraged and like felt like she had to defend me with her life.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay, so the reason I wanted to get you on is because, as usual, you challenged one of my thoughts or some stuff that I was saying, which, and you were completely right again, as usual. But I've spoken a little bit more, I would say, about processed foods, and what I should have definitely said is like ultra highly processed foods. But I think, so you've written an incredible article on processed foods and actually why they shouldn't get such a bad reputation. And I'd love you to speak on that.
Yeah, so I wrote an article in Wired on, like, I had the like kind of clickbait title, The World Needs More Processed Food. And I think the basic point I was making there is that I think from both like a human nutritional point of view and an environmental point of view, like there is massive scope for like processed foods to play like a positive role. I think everyone very much associates them with like negative, like either like negative environmentally or like definitely from like a health perspective. They equate like processed equals bad, natural equals good. And I think it's just very, very wrong. Like, it's true that there are highly processed foods which are like generally pretty bad for your health, especially if you're eating them in large quantities. But just kind of putting everything that's processed in this like same bucket is like completely wrong, because there's a massive spectrum and there's areas where processed food can have a massively positive impact, and then there's areas obviously where it can have a negative one.
Mm-hmm. So what are the positives of processed food?
So, and I often think about this, like often my work focuses like a large level on like global health, global nutrition. And I think, so like a lot of my work then focuses on like historical nutrition and then like also like nutrition in like lower income countries. And like processed food has like played a massive role in like tackling like micronutrient deficiencies, for example, where, so I'll take the example of like in a lot of like low income countries, or like how we would eat in the past, like our diets have massively diversified over time, but in the past we would have like a diet of like staples, like a lot of it's coming from like cereal crops, which like you can get a ton of calories from, but like micronutrient wise they're really, really poor. But what processed food does is you can just add them, right? You can add iron, calcium, vitamin B12, all of the nutrients that would cost a lot of money to get from a diverse diet, which a lot of people in the world just can't afford. You can just add these nutrients to the food, and with like basically pennies, you can tackle like a big issue of malnutrition. I think that was true for like rich countries historically. And we're now to the point where most people, not everyone, but a lot of people can afford like a diverse diet. So they can get iron, calcium, et cetera, from like a range of different foods. But that wasn't true in the past. And for like billions of people still in the world, that's still not the case.
And what about food waste? So is that something that processing helps? Like, does it increase the shelf life of foods?
Yeah, for a lot of foods, it can increase the shelf life, which is obviously good for like reducing food waste. I think it very much depends on the food. Like some foods, like people just want fresh food, and that's like perfectly valid. And therefore, like you don't need to go for like processed equivalents. But for a lot of foods, it just increases the shelf life. And if it doesn't have a negative impact on the nutrition, then especially from an environmental point of view, that's just a positive.
Mm. Yeah, and then I guess when you get into like the nitty-gritty of what processed actually means, like does that mean any kind of processing, like for example, like you wouldn't drink milk without it being slightly processed, right? Because it would be dangerous to do so, like where, and again, that's probably where the line should be drawn between, like one of my recommendations as like a blanket health recommendation is like let's eat as little, or try to eat as many whole foods as possible, and as little, like I should define it as like highly processed foods as possible. Like some aren't bad, but like you don't want to fill your diet with that. But then there's this kind of middle ground where like actually in this day and age, most foods been like to some extent processed, depending on how you're thinking about the definition of that. And I'm sure, sorry, I've gone really blurry. I don't really know why. I'm sure that there's like, that there are some foods that people wouldn't deem as processed that are processed. Do you think that's some of the like miscommunication there?
Yeah, so there's like a food processing scale where like it ranges from, I can't eat seriously.
Sorry, I don't really know why. It's like gone, right on my palaces, not on my face. Sorry for everyone.
We'll just carry on.
I know. It's like I'm in one of those like crime scenes and they're like, yeah. Someone, you don't want to see their face.
Yeah, exactly. And then you can say anything and we'll never know who it was.
No one will.
Oh, you're back. You're back. Anyway, right, as I was saying, there's like a scale of like food processing where actually nearly every food is processed to some extent. Like maybe there's a few examples where, I don't know, you pick like tomatoes from your garden and there's no processing involved there. But like basic stuff like cereals, like you don't just eat the wheat from the field. Like there's like husking, for example, is like a form of processing. So like nearly every food that we eat is processed to some extent, and there's a large scale on that, and you get to like one end where it's like ultra processed, where it's gone through a ton of processing, loads of stuff is added, and again, not all of the stuff that's added is necessarily bad, but like a ton of stuff is added. Like I think there's just so many examples of where stuff is processed and people just underestimate how much value it adds. Like this morning I was discussing with Shona, I was listening to a podcast, Freakonomics, this is a tangent, but they were discussing the question of like how important is breastfeeding for like a child's outcomes. Like, is breastfeeding actually better than like using like milk powder? And like even there, like the powder that a lot of women rely on because they can't breastfeed or it's really painful, like without that, like that's so crucial to like child outcomes, and that is a processed food because stuff has been added for like very good reason.
Yeah, and like so many cereals are like fortified now, right?
Mm.
Whatever folic acid or whatever's being added. Yeah, do you think that most of the, I was gonna say stigma, it's not even that, but like pushback around processed food, especially from like the ultra healthy fitness type people, is to do with like this natural fallacy that people fall for, where like anything that's natural is inherently better than something that's unnatural for you.
Yeah, I think a lot of it stems from that. I think, and I like, I kind of get it emotionally. Like, I also like in my head, I have this weird association of like, oh, I feel better when I'm eating this like fresh fruit and veg. I think a lot of it comes down, like a lot of people have the impression of like, if there's ingredients in there that there's this common like mantra, like if there's something in there that I can't pronounce, then I don't like it. Like, I think it comes back to people feel more secure knowing exactly what's in their food. And if there's a long list of ingredients, they feel less secure because they don't know exactly what it is. But the point is, like, because it's made in a lab or because you can't pronounce it, like has zero bearing on whether it's healthy or not. But I see this a lot, and I think you're obviously more involved in like the fitness health space. Like, I'm much more involved in like the environmental space, where I think the natural fallacy is like just as strong, if not stronger there. And I think for me, like one of the motivations for writing the article is that I see it a lot. So if you draw the Venn diagram, and I can now say this because I'm a vegan, so it sounds like I'm taking a pop at vegans, but I'm also taking a pop at myself. If you draw the Venn diagram of vegans and people that are really bought into like this, like fresh, natural, has to like no extra ingredients, no processing, like the overlap is very, very strong. It's almost like a circle, right? Like, vegans love this stuff. But I think from an environmental perspective, that massively gets in the way, because as I argue often, like one of the most important things we can do for the environment is eat less meat and move towards a more plant-based diet. And what a lot of people in that sphere would want people to do is like eat less meat, but instead eat lentils, beans, peas, like stay away from those like terrible processed like meat substitutes. And to me, that's like such a counterproductive like message to put out, because a lot of people don't want to eat the lentils or the peas or the beans. I don't want to eat the lentils, the peas or the beans. And like, this is such, these processed meat substitutes are such an easy way for people to eat less meat. And I think they're like, they're just really going to backfire this move towards a more plant-based diet if they're like basically saying it's really, really terrible if you eat these products. Because I did like comparisons of, so all of these products, like, I don't know, Linda McCartney sausages or like the Beyond Meat burger, the Impossible burger, like those are defined as ultra processed if you go by the like actual like definition and terminology. But like, I looked at the nutritional profile of those compared to like a normal burger or normal chicken and stuff. And like on all of the metrics that you would define as like bad for like highly processed food, so like higher in calories or like higher in saturated fat or lower in protein or low in fiber, like the meat substitutes come out better than the meat nearly all the time. So they have lower calories. So if you're switching from a beef burger to an Impossible burger, you're probably eating less calories. The protein is roughly equivalent, less saturated fat, often less sodium, higher fiber. So like all of the negative qualities that you'd frame around these highly processed foods, like the meat substitutes come up slightly better. So if people are going to do like a like for like switch, like nutritionally, they're just as good to eat the meat substitutes.
Mm. And then another article you wrote was about whether meat substitutes are actually better for the environment. What did you find there?
Yeah, so like loads of analyses that have been done in the past, like they always agree on the fact that like eating like plant-based foods is better than meat in terms of like environmental impact. So like you're better to eat lentils or beans than you are to eat beef. And they're like, the differences there are massive. But like what was really lacking was like not like the peas and the beans and the lentils, but like the stuff that people want to eat, like the Impossible burger or the Beyond Meat burger. So I was like, oh, but I just need to like look at the data and see what it actually says. Cause like a lot of people will make the argument of like, this stuff's made in a lab, it makes uses tons of energy. Like there's absolutely no way that like all of this could be better than like my like cow coming from the field, which is like seems like a valid argument. But no, when you look at the data, it's exactly the same. Like a lot of the meat substitutes are like, they tend to be like, in terms of like carbon footprint, slightly higher than like the just the like raw plant-based foods. But they're still less than meat, and often significantly so. So like an Impossible burger or a Beyond Meat burger, you're talking like 10 to 50 times less CO2 than a beef burger. So if you basically, my point is, if you want to go towards like a plant-based diet and like you love the like the raw plant-based foods, great, go for it. But a lot of people, like, that's a barrier to them making that switch. So if you want to do it and you want to switch a beef burger for one of the other like meat substitute burgers, it's still making a massive difference. And I think that you shouldn't let the "this is a highly processed food" get in the way of making that switch.
Agreed. And I love the nutritional comparison as well. And from your talk in Dundee, one of the biggest things that was like a bit of a take home was realizing that actually eating local isn't half as beneficial as what people might think. So they might think that they're massively cutting their carbon footprint because now they pay a bit more to eat local beef versus beef from wherever beef comes from, very far away. But what was so interesting about your talk was that actually, you know, your logic would think, oh, well, if this has come halfway across the world to get to my plate, surely that's a huge carbon footprint, but not the case.
No, and I think this is, I think what I'm like slowly becoming famous for is like, I'm just like anti-local gal. And like, I think in some sense, my message has been like, it's like gonna get misconstrued. My point is like, not to not eat local. If you want to eat local, eat local. But the point is that the what you eat just matters way, way more than how far it's traveled to come to you. So the differences in the carbon footprint between different food products. So as I was saying, like beef is like, you're talking like 10 to 50 times more CO2 than from most plant-based foods. The differences that you would get in terms of the emissions from like transporting that are like just so, so small in comparison to the differences between foods. So like food transport, although we're like moving stuff all around the world, is like 5% of foods emissions. So yeah, the transport is 5%, and like the food that you're eating, how it's produced, is the other 95%. So if you're focusing on the 5%, you're focusing on the wrong thing.
Yeah. I think some people, I don't know if it's, I think it is actually a lack of awareness thing, because it does make sense. And then when you realize that, you're like, wow, it does matter what I eat, not just where it comes from.
I think the big reason there that people get wrong is that I think people imagine if they're buying something from another country, it's been flown to them. And if it is being flown to you, then it does have a high carbon footprint. But the point is that most foods are not flown. They like come by ship, and like shipping is very, very efficient. So like for the majority of your foods, like it just doesn't make a massive difference how far it's traveling. There's a small minority of foods where it is being flown to you, and there it will have a high carbon footprint. And people always ask me like, oh, like how do I spot it? Like there's a few things that you can, that makes it easier to spot. But to me, like the most straightforward thing we should be doing is just putting like a label on foods if it's been flown. Like it's like the, like it's such a binary, like a lot, I know like loads of like food labels and stuff, like there's so many debates about like a grading score or like what qualifies as like a green or an amber or red, but like this is so simple, like either it's flown or it's not, like it's a binary thing. It should be like very, very simple to implement.
And then what kind of foods are they? Like give me some examples that usually are flown.
Yeah, so the reason that people, that most food is not flown is that it's just super expensive, right? And energy intensive. So like companies are not going to fly it to you unless it really, really needs to get to you quickly. So it's the foods that would go off really, really quickly and you need to buy fresh that have come from the other side of the world. So like very common examples are like asparagus, for example, if it's imported from, like often it's like the classic example is like Peru. Like Peru exports a lot of asparagus and there it's probably flown. Other examples are like green beans from the other side of the world or berries from the other side of the world, like stuff that's going to go off very, very quickly if you don't eat it. And it's coming from continents away has probably been flown.
So like lots of the staple vegan foods?
Some of them. No. So soy, definitely not. So soy is perfectly fine. Soy and avocados definitely come by ship. And that's the classic... Yeah.
Huh.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, you get one and it's like it will only be ripe for like 24 hours. Yeah. I just assumed that that would be like quite time imminent.
No, soy and avocados shipped. I think those are the classic things that people like take a pop at vegans for, is like, oh, you think you're good, but your like avocado is shipped all the way from Brazil. But actually, it's fine. Your avocado's from Brazil, I'm perfectly fine.
Yeah, that's interesting. So speaking of your vegan journey, you're like fully vegan now, right? I feel like you regressed and I massively regressed.
Like what? Yeah, you were trying it for a while, right?
Yeah. Then I was like almost there. So I was like vegetarian for a long time. Well, actually I was pescatarian for like years, basically. Now and again with a little bit of chicken, but I actually didn't really find it hard not to eat chicken. Anyway, then I like stopped eating the meat altogether for a period of time, and slowly it's just managed to come back in. And you know what it started with? Fish fingers.
Fish fingers?
No, which is so
weird. I did not have you down as a finger fish girl. A fish finger girl.
Yeah, no, I mean, to be honest, neither did I, but it was really like I had one and I was like, this is great. And then I realized it was like, I can't remember if it's like 3 or 4 fish fingers for about like 250 calories and 20 grams of protein. And I was like, this is me.
Oh, 20 grams of protein is good for free fish fingers.
And, you know, cheap and easy. And that's, I'm a cheap and easy girl for sure. So that's basically where it started. And it's not going that well. But I do think maybe it'll be like the New Year resolution. I'll be like, right, I'm going back to, I feel good vegetarian. I think I found, not that I ever massively tried it, but vegan was quite hard and I still ate a lot of eggs. So that was the main non-vegan part of it.
Like the fish is one product where like I don't think we're quite there with like the vegan substitutes.
Well, I've not tried it, but when I was in Aldi yesterday, there was like a fish-free fish finger. And I was like,
I was going to say, maybe like, I actually think that's one where it might actually be okay because like there's like batter around it, right?
Yeah, like it's
just, you're not just eating raw fish. I mean, I don't know what the protein content of it would be like.
I'll scope it out and see.
Like, most of the meat substitute products I like and are really good, but there's like some of like the substitutes that are really just like taking the piss. Like recently I tried vegan baby bells.
Oh, what was it?
Guess what? They're just made from coconut oil. Guess how much protein was in them? One baby bell.
What's the normal protein? Like 10 grams?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Because I was buying them like, oh, this would be a good way to like, no, actually, it was Catherine that bought them. So Catherine bought them. She's like, I'll be really kind and I'll get Hannah vegan baby bells. Guess how much protein's in one?
2 grams.
Less than 0.01.
Like not even a trace. That's like a homeopathic
no. thing. Absolutely nothing. It's just like coconut oil.
Oh wow. Has Catherine gone full vegan or she's just vegetarian?
No. She's vegetarian. She does actually do pretty close to vegan. But no, she's vegetarian and like she occasionally eats fish. Like she maybe like once a week she has salmon.
Yeah. Well, anyway, what I was going to ask about that is, have you noticed anything in terms of hunger, mood, energy, performance, strength, like cognitive ability?
I think it's, I mean, obviously it's hard to like not attribute stuff to like other external factors. I think initially when I went vegan, I found it quite hard. It like took me a bit of time to get used to like what I should and could be eating, and like I think there's a ton of stuff that I was just not aware of, like milk in it, so I think it took some time to like build up like a regularly like a kind of routine diet where I was like, I know I'm kind of like hitting all the bases here, and this is like quite a safe diet vegan wise. So I think initially like I was not that happy with like the cognitive effort that was involved. Like generally I just don't like spending a lot of time thinking about food because it takes away from other stuff, but I did have to spend quite a bit of time thinking about it and planning. Now it's just like very, very routine and like I hardly think about it at all. I was like a little bit concerned that it would like impact like fitness, gym stuff, and it really hasn't at all. Like if anything, I think since I went vegan, I've got slightly stronger. I think I'm not going to put that down to the vegan diet. I don't think it's the vegan diet. I think I've actually just been trying harder in the gym, which is probably
despite it, not because of it. But it's interesting, like, because a lot of people think you can't. I actually got a question recently and it was like, do you know any athletes that have always been vegan instead of like, you know, there's like some that mm-hmm. are to being vegan. And obviously the kind of question within that question was like, do you think that you need to build muscle? And then sure, you might be able to maintain it on a vegan diet, but could you build that amount of muscle on a vegan diet? I mean, it's an interesting question. I think probably with all the meat substitutes and the ability to get in enough protein, like, yeah, I can't see why you couldn't do that. It would be harder just in terms of like the cognitive effort to get in that amount of protein, but I can't see why you wouldn't be able to do that.
No, neither do I. I mean, I think, yeah, with a well-planned vegan diet, I think you can hit all nutrition, obesities, and like protein-wise, yeah, I don't see why not. I think it would be harder. I think what's maybe slightly harder is, I think this is more applicable to women because they just tend to have like lower like calorie requirements, is like fitting enough protein in a lower calorie diet.
Yeah, I think that is hard. And yeah, and then I guess like eating out within that, because a lot of, when you eat out, a lot of the vegan foods are quite high in calories, or they're like, we need to make this taste nice, so we'll just add a load of butter or fat or something. Yeah. It needs to be a higher calorie option.
Or if you go out and if you go out and you're wanting to eat lower calorie, like at least if you're not vegan, you have a range of options to pick from. Whereas if you're vegan, like it's getting way, way better. And usually you do have a range of options. But like often you'll have like one or two to pick from, and if it's like 2,000 calories, then that's what you've got.
Yeah, and then I think it, you know, in the UK it's pretty good, and like London's amazing for vegan options. But if you go somewhere like Albania, they don't even know what a vegan is. Like not that a lot of people are going to Albania, but I guess places like, if you're traveling, and I know you, I can't remember, were you in France? And it was like, all I could really eat was like a pizza with no cheese on it.
When I started going vegan, I was like, I'm going to do a month trial and just see how it is. And if I find this really difficult, then I'll just go back to like vegetarian. And unfortunately, it was also the month I was like away with my team for a week in the south of France. And like, it was like, even vegetarianism was not a thing. So like veganism was just like on another planet. And yeah, so like I'd have to ask for like, can I just have a pizza with no cheese? And like the absolute shock on the face, like it was almost like blasphemy that you'd ask for this. And yeah, I ate no protein, basically no protein that week.
Yeah, I think.
Which is another thing like when eating out, like one is like you might only have one option and it might be really high calorie, but another is like it probably might not actually meet your protein requirements. So like sometimes the case that like you go out, have a meal, and then have to have a protein shake after to like actually make up the protein.
Yeah, like normally the option, or I know when I was trying to do this, like it would be someone would have a steak and you'd have a cauliflower steak, which is literally just like, it's sometimes it's quite nice, but it is just cauliflower. Now and again, you have a little bit of like hummus on the side, so maybe you're getting, I don't know, 3 grams of protein within that or something, but there was like no protein whatsoever. Yeah, so it is tough. But good that you've not noticed anything kind of, aside from like the cognitive effort of initially changing your diet, in terms of performance, like actually things are still going up, so.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it very much depends on like why people are going vegan and like what their motivation is. Like there's obviously the benefit for people that if they're doing it for like a specific reason, whether that's like, I don't know, ethical or environmental, like obviously there's also just the like cognitive, enjoyment's not the right word, but I don't know, like they maybe feel better in themselves doing that because they've done it for a specific reason. And I'm not just putting out like a vegan diet, that's just applicable to me, but for like people making a change to like lifestyle or diet or whatever, like if it's in line with what their values are, then there's also a benefit, a positive feeling to doing that change.
Yeah, I guess like if you're doing the kind of research you're doing, it may feel like a little bit incongruent to be like, here's all the evidence showing all of this, and like, oh, I still eat meat anyway. It could always be that kind of, yeah, like you probably feel better mentally for kind of practicing what you preach, even though you're not preaching in the slightest. You're just like, here's the information, do what you will with it, but this is the accurate information. And that's something that I've always admired about you. And interestingly, is makes you want to change more. I wrote a post about this morning, actually, because someone had asked, like, how do I get my family to be more healthy? And it made me think, like, actually, the worst thing you can possibly do is preach or nag or pressure someone into change. Like, they will immediately want to do the opposite thing. And same with a lot of this stuff. If you tell someone to do something, they probably want to do the exact opposite. Whereas if you give them the information and then they can feel good about the empowered choice that they're making because it's coming from them, they're much more likely to make those changes. So I think that's something that you do incredibly well.
Thank you. No, I never ever tell anyone what to eat because it's absolutely none of my business. But I have noticed that like a range of people around me, like for years after going vegetarian, like family and stuff, where I never would have thought, I mean, they're not, like none of my family are like even vegetarian, but they have like made significant changes in that direction. And like, not because I've told them to do it, I would never tell them to do it, but just from like seeing what I'm eating and be like, oh, I'll try a bit of that. And they're like, oh, that actually tastes quite good. I think like these like small changes like actually rub off on people.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what I started with, is like the best way to get someone to change is to inspire them to change. And that doesn't mean like, you might not know you're inspiring them to change, right? But that is an example of like someone else seeing what you're doing and being like, hey, I could make those changes too. So the last question I have for you, it's completely unrelated to any of this, but I was interested to hear what your thoughts are. And it was a question that like really triggered me, and I've actually spoken about it loads on the podcast.
Oh no.
Okay. As one of the most impressive people I know, do you think that someone else with the same skill set and abilities that you have could be doing more than what you're doing at the moment?
Yeah, 100%. I think that luck plays a massive role in where you end up. And I think there are loads of people that have the same skills as me, the same attributes as me, that work as hard as me. Probably work hard, there will be people that work harder that are not in the same position. And it's because I think I've done all of the above, but I've also just had like lucky breaks. I think people massively underestimate the role that luck plays, whether that's where you're born, like where you're born and the environment you're born into is like such, like it's just a lucky draw. Who you make contact with can get you really far. Like, I think luck plays a massive role. There are the counter arguments to that is that like there are ways of like increasing the likelihood that you stumble on luck. And I think for me, like the biggest thing there is I see it as like increasing your surface area to like spontaneity. So like I think a big thing for me is like I'm more from like an academic background where it's like typical that you would almost like write in private and you would share like pieces of work with colleagues and peers, but it never really goes very far. I'm like very much an advocate of like doing work in public. So like being really public, posting publicly, and when you do the podcast, like publishing on a blog. And I think just by like being out there in the public domain, you massively increase the chances that someone sees your work and stumbles on you. I think luck plays a massive role, and there's a way of increasing your luck just by putting yourself out there.
And then I think the harder you work, the luckier you are as well. Like it's one thing meeting someone, but if you're not, you haven't also done the work to be extremely impressive when you meet that person, or to kind of have, you know, if someone stumbled upon your blog in it and there was nothing good on it, they just keep stumbling through the internet, right? But if they're like, oh wow, this article was great, hey, I'll listen to this podcast, oh actually I might actually message her and see if she's interested in XYZ, that's how the opportunities happen. But you need to do like the hard work in the background. So I think you're right, like it's the combination of luck, which is sort of driven by actually how much you work, and then also having worked hard.
Right. What was your answer?
I really liked this question because it really made me think I could be achieving so much more. And it's interesting because some people view that as like almost being very self-critical of like, God, I'm not good enough, I should be doing more. But to me, it was just like quite eye-opening of like, hey, like actually there's so much more potential here. And that's quite an exciting thing, as opposed to beating myself up because I should be doing X, Y, Z. I was just like, no, actually gives you a bit of perspective over if you can make it someone else. Hey, someone else who has your abilities, your experience, your skill set, like almost like it kind of creates the question in your head of like, what would you say to them to get the best out of them? Or what would you tell them to do? What advice would you give to them? Which is easier than giving yourself advice. And I think it's probably the pushing towards perspective that I think makes that question quite interesting.
It's also, I think it also depends on what you mean by like doing more or getting more, because there's an opportunity cost, right? Like you and maybe you like see it in like a doing more or getting more in like a business sense, but like there's an opportunity cost to that, whether it's, I don't know, fitness or family or whatever, or an alternative work related route that's not about like family and stuff, but like an alternative work related route that's not about one specific business. So I think it very much depends what you mean by like doing or getting more.
Yeah, I get it's achieving more, but then like your definition of achieving or success will vary. Yeah, anyway, I thought it was a good one to make people think. But thank you very much for your time. That has been so interesting as ever. And I hope to have you back soon.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you as ever for your time and attention. If you want to talk to me about coaching, or if you want to find out more about how to work with me, head over to esgfitness.co.uk. There is also lots of free information on the website and some worksheets, which I hope you will find useful. If you've enjoyed this episode, I would love to hear from you. Please tag me in your stories at esgfitness, or shoot me a message. And if you think you know anyone who would enjoy this episode, why not share it with them? Thanks, guys!